This is Terms of Reference. I'm your host, Stephen Laddick. Alessandra Pigny has run the blog Mindful Next since 2011 to help aid workers build resilience, prevent burnout, and keep sane while serving others in the field. Trained as a clinical psychologist, she has worked as a psychologist with Medicine Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, and as a consultant with local and international NGOs, spending a good part of the last 7 years in Palestine. She is currently a visiting research fellow at the University of Oxford, working on a book on aid workers' well-being. I spoke with Alessandra in London. Hello, Alessandra. Thank you so much for being on the Terms of Reference podcast today.
Hi, Stephen. I'm really glad to be on the show.
Where am I calling you today?
I'm in London today.
It's February in London right now as we're recording this, so I hope that you're seeing some sunshine somewhere.
Not today, but that's okay. Yesterday it was sunny.
So, Alessandra, you operate a website or a blog called Mindful Next. I thought this was going to be a really interesting topic for our listeners here on this podcast because you focus on burnout, you focus on issues of self-care, mindfulness, and how specifically that relates to the development and aid profession. Let's start by, Why don't you tell us about your story? How did you find your way to this place? Were you an aid worker before, et cetera? Or give us that background.
Yes. I'm a psychologist. That's my profession. It's one of the hats that I wear. And in 2008, I went to work in Palestine with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, as we all know it. So that was my first field experience. And I was working with Palestinian families in the West Bank, in the city of Nablus. And as I was meeting, these people, the work that I was doing was actually extremely interesting and very enriching. And I was very lucky because as a psychologist, I was entitled to a monthly supervision, which was a wonderful space for us as a team, the clinical team, but also like for me individually, I had the opportunity.
Others may not know, want to butt in there. What is a monthly supervision? What does that
mean? Okay, yeah, sorry. Yes, it basically when people work as psychologists or psychotherapists, they need to have someone who is external to their work environment who kind of supports them, checks on them, gives them some guidance. And it's a supervisor. So generally, one can bring cases. If there is a case that is particularly challenging, you can discuss this with the supervisor, who is a person who is more senior than you and has more experience, and can support you in that in your work. At the same time, because the work that we do as psychologists is very personal issues that come up as well, that might be triggered by a case, but they also, in the case of working as a psychologist for a humanitarian organization, they might be triggered by many other things, by the difficulties of the context, by issues in the organization, you name it. There are so many issues that could come up. So I felt very lucky that I had this possibility of checking in every month with somebody who was a great professional, an amazing woman, and who actually, I guess we really clicked somehow. And not only was she available for this team supervision, but she also left her door open for me to talk about, to check in with her when I needed, I could give her a call or just when I was visiting Jerusalem, where she was based, I could, get in touch and see if I could go and have a chat with her.
So take us back to, you were doing this work and you were working with Palestinians. Or you're working in Palestine, excuse me.
I was working in Palestine with Palestinian families affected by the political violence. That was the work that I was doing. So I was meeting with women, often going to doing home visits, going to their home, and basically really just listening to what they had been through. I was working with children, I was working with men, so all sorts of different groups, because everybody's affected by the political violence in that part of the world. And I have to say that that kind of work was really somehow for me very I don't want to use like silly words like empowering because it sounds ridiculous, but it was something that made my work meaningful somehow. Okay. Mm-hmm. To meet these people, to hear their stories, and really to learn from their resilience and their ability to never give up, you know, after decades of what happens in Palestine. So I was really like inspired by these people. They were my kind of like, they kept me sane because I thought they have so much challenges and difficulties and violence in their life, and they're really showing resilience and strength. And at the same time, I could see that what was difficult for me and for other people working in the sector were much more like team conflicts, feeling isolated, feeling lonely, not feeling that one didn't have much support. And so that's when I really started to think about who is supporting us, who is helping us, because mm-hmm. I come from a place where I think that people who are in helping professions, and humanitarian work is one of them. We may not like the label helping professions, but I don't like it. But for lack of a better word, that's what I will use. I think we come with lots of personal issues, and through helping others, through humanitarian work, through sometimes running away from your own country and going somewhere else thinking that will fix the problems, we were searching some kind of healing. And so I thought, you know, we're here in this very difficult environment. The problems that we bring with ourselves are not going to go away. And unless we kind of bring some awareness to them and work.
Have you done a study or anything that would back that up? Or has there been enough psychological work done on aid workers or development workers that would show that what, you know, we do bring issues with us into the field, or that we are a profession of people who...
I think we're human beings.
Yeah.
So that's, everybody has issues.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
So it may not even be necessarily sort of like specific to this profession, but I think as human beings, you know, we all have problems, issues, big or small. And I can talk about my personal experience, observations, lots of aid workers I talk to, lots of stories that I've heard. There is sometimes an element of looking for what you cannot find in your home country, mm-hmm. looking for it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. There is also an element, sometimes it could be of, you know, thinking that you can leave your problems behind. That could be true as well.
So take us to, how did you end up deciding to build Mindful Next as a resource?
Oh, yeah. So there was these two, I would say, pillars of support that I had, you know, like this possibility of talking to someone who was not part of the organization and who at the same time had experience with humanitarian organizations and had an understanding of what it meant to work in aid. And on the other hand, I had, you know, my mindfulness practice, which was very simple. You know, I would just practice some meditation every morning before going to work, you know, because I knew I needed that sort of kind of space, some silence, a quiet moment before, you know, having like a security meeting, before going to the field, and before, you know, meeting clients, and before being hit by all that goes on in the everyday life of an aid worker, whatever that means. So that for me was just, you know, like a really something very simple and useful. And having seen that, actually, this was something that was, I would say, essential for me. Both the, you know, like having this space, which, you know, for me, you know, it was a mindfulness practice. I really don't think that I'm not, you know, like campaigning for the fact that everybody has to practice mindfulness, or that that's the only way forward to keep sane in the field. I think people have to find their own way and their own rhythm, but it's necessary. I think it is necessary to find a space that allows you to check in with yourself mm-hmm. for a moment, because otherwise it feels like being in a blender all the time. It's not possible to think straight, feel straight, you know, like it's not possible to really operate very well. If, you know, imagine being, you know, I use this image of the blender, being in a blender all the time. and I think that sometimes how, for me, how aid work felt, with, you know, good and bad, you know, because it's very active, it's very interesting, you always meet new people, and you know, there's really an element of activism that is there, and it's great.
Would you say that it's beyond the work as well? Obviously the work itself has,
so you mean lifestyle?
Yeah, I'm saying going beyond the work into lifestyle. We're leaving our home culture, our home country. We're far from home, we're with new people.
Yeah. This kind
of, so is that all a part of the melange, so to speak?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I mean, all of this has positive and you know, like negative sides. You know, it's great to go to another country. It's great to be able to go to places where, you know, you couldn't really go as a tourist sometimes. You know, it's not like mm-hmm. you go there as a tourist, but there are places that
you have access. You have access to interesting and unique experiences.
Exactly. You have access to places that otherwise would be impossible to visit somehow. And you really, you know, get into the culture, you have the possibility to interact with people who live in that country, and it's a constant learning experience. This is, I think, it's one of the beauty of aid work. I felt that I was always learning something. I was always meeting interesting people, having interesting conversations, and all of that is very positive. And I think there's also a point where you cannot be on a high all the time. No, you just kind of need to land for a moment. Yeah. That's what I felt I needed.
Is that what mindfulness offers to others?
Yes, I would say that what it offers is like a breathing space, a reflective space, a moment to pause and reflect about why we're doing this, and also a place where people can find some support and feel that when things don't go so well, when, you know, aid work is not so exciting for some reason, you know, because there are problems, because one is has been in it for too long, maybe, you know, and
do you have a specific story maybe you could share, either with someone you've worked with or someone that you've, obviously you can't reveal names, those kinds of things, but maybe give us a story about a specific event, or maybe somebody who just had the classic, they've been doing this for 10 years or 15 years and it just all added up.
There is a post that I wrote with a colleague of mine, and the post, it's a quick guide to getting out of aid work.
Ah, okay.
And
sure.
The reason why we wrote this post is because, I mean, I can talk for myself. I had heard so many stories of people who wanted to move on. They wanted to do something else. You know, as much as aid work had been a great part, you know, a really important part of their life and still was, they wanted to get out. And yes, I can think of a number of people that, whether it was in a more formal, actually, work situation where, you know, like I was supporting them, you know, providing mentoring and coaching, or whether it was a completely informal situation, you know, like there was a point where at every social gathering, you know, whether it was a party or a meal in a restaurant and there were aid workers, the moment I told people what I did, that my work involved working with humanitarian professionals, writing about burnout, supporting people who had difficulties in their career in aid work, you know, like I was like flooded with the sort of stories about how, you know, one person had enough and they wanted to move on and get out, and how to do it. It was so difficult. So I think at some point, you know, after having heard so many stories, I thought, maybe this is something we're not talking about. You know, there are so many articles about how to get into aid work.
Well, I was going to reflect as well. I'm listening sort of with a half smile on my face while we're having this. Simply because, you know, this podcast that we're on right now, so much of it is, how do I get that first job? How do I get into the organization? How do I create the consulting practice? In other words, how do I create and craft and grow and build a career? But this,
yeah,
I think, it's a part of that story. It's a part of that arc. And
I think so.
I think when you get to the point where all you're talking about is getting out, you really haven't achieved the balance that's necessary for that, what I call a satisfying and sustainable career.
Yeah. So, you know, I can totally understand all these articles that are about getting into aid work because, you know, back, you know, 2006, 2007, when I joined MSF, I, you know, that's really what I wanted to do. You know, I thought this organization was amazing. And I still think that, you know, what they do is, you know, really incredible work in some parts of the world. So I thought I want to be one of them. I have to say that there is this kind of myth of the aid worker, you know, like as if.
Oh,
you know,
I want to hear them. People, I want to hear what's your version of the myth?
Well, I bought into that myth as well. So, you know, like when I joined MSF, you know, like it was kind of ridiculous at the beginning, you know, like I slept in my MSF t-shirt because I thought that was like really super cool.
I love that. That's awesome. That's
so, you know, like, you know, there is this idea that, you know, these are like people who selfless and go out there and help others, and they help people who have absolutely nothing. They don't have a clue. And, you know, I'm just, you know, being, but the, you know, there is this, you know, I think we would agree that there is an idea that's, there is this kind of heroic image.
There's definitely heroic. There's definitely a mythology, and there's definitely, you know, we've described it, or I've described it on in Aidpreneur, is, you know, it's a profession filled of wickedly smart, hugely passionate people, right?
Mm.
And that's a, for lack of a better term, a deadly combination, because many times they're unreasonable.
Yeah, absolutely. But so going back to the idea of, you know, getting out of aid work rather than getting in. I'm first, you know, like I know that I've also read some comments, you know, on that specific post, people saying, "Oh, I've been trying to get out to get in," you know, and so I get it, you know, people want to know how do I get in, but I guess I'm talking to a different audience, you know. If you are 22, 25. You know, of course you want to get in, you know, that is, you know, if you're interested in that sort of career, because it is a career, you know, it's not just something that you do because you have nothing to do for 6 months. You know, you need to be prepared for the field. You need to be prepared professionally. You need to be prepared emotionally. And I think this is something that actually we don't do very well. You know, like people are just sent to the field on like a week notice. And if they're lucky, they get the appropriate briefing. If there's no time, you just go and you will learn. So actually, this is the great thing also, that you learn so much because you have to learn. You know, it's like either you swim or you drown sometimes.
Well, let me reflect on that as well. Even if you have, as you would say, the appropriate briefing, there is still, and the reason, one of the reasons why I love the mindfulness aspect of the work that you put out there, is that's a critical element of it, because it affects us all differently. Situations affect us all differently, and even with the best preparation in the world,
absolutely,
you still have to pay attention to yourself. And one of the things I find most compelling about your work and the work that you write about is, where is that support mechanism? You do have a net, so to speak.
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's a question for humanitarian organizations to think about. But not, I know I can come across as a bit challenging, and I am. But I think we really need to think also about the kind of support, the kind of either, you know, preparation. And preparation doesn't mean that everything will be fine. That's a given, you know. But it means that people have some kind of awareness of what could go wrong. And so it doesn't come as a shock when they see that actually, you know, working in a humanitarian organization, you know, it's that the work environment at the end of the day is not that different from what could be a profit organization, maybe.
Absolutely.
And that is a bit of a taboo, because, you know, we're all nice people. We're all good people. I think that's just something to reflect on. And I mean, some of the people I've met in aid are indeed incredible people. I've also met some people that you really hope that they will never cross your path again, because they're dangerous.
Sure.
For themselves and others.
Well, it's just like any sector, any other profession. It attracts all personalities for all different kinds of reasons. And
yeah, and yeah. But I also think, you know, the idea that you know, helping is a form of power. Generosity can be a form of power. And these kind of things are not, they don't come, you know, like we're all neutral and independent and we're just being nice. That's a bit naive.
Mm. I want to unpack the idea. You have another post on your site called Why Self-Care is Not Enough. You were kind of going there just a few seconds ago. Tell me about that a little bit more. What's the package you're talking about here about why self-care is not enough?
I want to be clear on one thing. First of all, is that self-care is useful,
mm-hmm.
but it's not enough.
Even before we go that far, sometimes I need to remember that many of our listeners are people just getting into the aid business first, you know, for the first time, people who are transitioning from another career. Tell us about what do you mean by self-care? What does that mean?
I think it's pretty much what I was discussing earlier about finding a space that is your space of sanity and where you can really sort of check in with yourself.
Truly step away from the work.
Have a
quote-unquote normal life kind of thing.
And I'm not talking about work-life balance, because if you want work-life balance, you don't work in aid.
I
think people want a meaningful life. They want a meaningful career. They want a meaningful job. They want to see that what they're doing has a purpose. And certainly I've met very few people who are, you know, talking about work-life balance when they get into aid. Then they read a post about work-life balance and they think that that's what they need to do when they are, you know, like maybe in Afghanistan. I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's, then if you're looking for work-life balance, then maybe you're not in the right field. But that doesn't mean that you have to accept the fact that you will eventually burn out. So to carve some kind of space for yourself regularly, every day if possible, and that will allow you to just look after yourself a bit. Spend some quality time with yourself that is not in front of a screen, that is not on the phone, in a meeting. It's just sort of like switching off all the noise that comes from outside. And then you may find that, and you sit quietly for a moment, there is a lot of noise inside, which is inside your head.
Mm-hmm.
And that is difficult as well. So this is why I'm not sort of advocating mindfulness meditation for everybody, because that may not be appropriate. But I am suggesting that each one of us could really benefit from finding a way to keep healthy, keep sane, look after yourself, do something that you enjoy, even in the most difficult situations. You know, I'm just giving, you know, like an example. When I was in Lebanon, I joined a hiking group. I was going hiking every Sunday.
Mm.
And
there's some beautiful places in Lebanon.
And there are some beautiful places. And, you know, like I remember talking to a friend and she said, everywhere I go on a mission, I try and find a hiking group. And I was like, but I mean, sure, you know, we're very spoiled here in Lebanon, because it's not possible everywhere. She said, you will not believe it. I went hiking in Afghanistan.
Sure.
And I was like, okay. You know, like, so I think it's really like a question.
And you could say, you know, I'm thinking of the Hash House Harriers or something like that, where almost everywhere we've ever gone, there's always a running group or some other activity group like that that meets regularly. You know, it's a community of support in many ways other than just sort of let's go have some fun together.
Yeah, and I think that's what I mean about self-care, which is, by the way, another term that I think it's just, you know, really, I don't like it. It's too
overused, abused,
new agey. You know, I really don't doesn't sit very well with me. But again, you know,
so why isn't self-care enough? What else needs to be a part of that equation?
Aid workers are not just sitting there on their own in the field. You know, they work for an organization. They interact with other people, and so. I think that aid organizations have a duty of care and need to provide support to their staff. But this is somewhere, the way I see it, is a little bit different. When I talk about support, I'm not thinking about, you know, psychological support following a security incident. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's necessary for some people. Not everybody wants it. I've seen an organization trying to impose it on their staff and people didn't want it. People were like, I don't want to talk to somebody I've never met in my life before. So that's also, you know, like getting out of that sort of, okay, now we're going to make staff care and duty of care like into protocols and policies. And I don't think that's going to work. I can see where that's coming from because, you know, many, if we're talking about big humanitarian organizations or aid organizations, of course, they need to have some kind of rules and regulations and policies in place, because that's how bureaucratic organizations work. And we know that there is a lot of, you know, bureaucracy in international organizations and in big NGOs. That's part of, you know, the way they operate. That's also what makes them work sometimes, you know, to have those protocols in place. But when it comes to staff care, I think there has to be the ability to see the person in front of you, you know, the ability to really connect with who are the people in the field and understand what their needs are. For some people, it may be, you know, that they have a need to talk to a psychologist on a regular basis. Some people may not want that. There's mentoring, there's coaching. And I think it's also a question about asking people what can help them, rather than just saying, well, this is what we can offer. You know, sure, really finding it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's about, and this is something that it's a bit tricky and difficult, being aware of the type of work culture that has been created in an organization. And that's, you know, it's very difficult to define, you know, what is the work culture of an NGO. But I'm sure if you think about a specific organization, you know, our listeners can think about organizations they're working for, and what it feels like to work in that environment.
Mm.
Is it a work environment where it's people feel listened to, where people feel shut down, where, you know, that sort of things. And those are the things. It's the kind of like the day in and day out that really matters. You know, that's where people burn out.
Sure.
People don't burn out because they were in a traumatic situation. That's completely wrong.
That's where you get post-traumatic stress syndrome.
It's possible that you develop that. It's not a given, you know. It doesn't mean that, you know, you were not...
I was just trying to separate the two events. If you're in a traumatic situation, there are other emotional and mental effects.
Yeah.
Burnout is more of a cumulative effect of the day-to-day practice.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because it's popped into my mind. You've talked several times in our call here about mindfulness activity. You know, you've chosen meditation as your particular one, you know, your particular practice. Have you had the opportunity to speak with others in faith-based organizations? I'm thinking, you know, some of the largest responders, some of the largest NGOs they're very faith-focused.
Mm-hmm.
Have you experienced the same kind of burnout, the same kind of issues?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting question, because, you know, one of the groups that are highly affected, you know, by burnout is, you know, missionaries. So that's
really
interesting
to me. Yeah, that was not a baited question by any means. It just popped into my head and I was wondering, but that's...
I think I remember there was a book that came out that was a while back. You know, I'm thinking over 15 years ago. And I remember reading it in Italian, so I cannot quote the title in English, but it was specifically a book about burnout among missionaries. And I was really shocked to find out that this was a big problem. But at the same time, it's not that surprising, because a burnout hits people with ideals. You know, like people who are searching for some kind of meaning and purpose. And, you know, there is this kind of idealism. So you find it in activists, you find it in humanitarian professionals. So it's not that surprising that you find it also among missionaries. I think this is, there's a kind of trend, and, you know, like... you know, aid workers somehow sometimes are perceived a bit like missionaries, you know, like people going to other countries and...
Sure. You bring a different kind of doctrine, I guess.
Yeah, you bring a secular doctrine maybe. But yeah, so I think it's what really interests me about... question is, you know, why do I talk about burnout so much? Is that, you know, it's really an issue that touches people who are looking for something, to do something meaningful in their life, through their career, through their profession, if we don't want to use the word career, but through their, you know, their work. And in a way, the system that we're in, it's almost pre-programmed for burnout, because not only because people work way too much, because that is not the key issue. You know, there are people who work a lot and they're very happy in their work.
Sure. What's the key issue there?
Well, it goes back to the work environment, having a supportive work environment, seeing your work appreciated and recognized.
Let me dive deeper there. Would you say that there may be a fundamental juxtaposition with aid work? Because another sort of, for lack of a better term, elephant in the room is that so much of aid work or development work requires the 20 to 30 year perspective, right? Where the initiatives, so there's two thoughts here. One is that any development initiative, truly development, right? We're not talking emergencies, crises, et cetera, is a long-term social behavior change initiative. And therefore, you know, you can work really long hours, you can work really hard and show up 5 years later and have a really hard time seeing real tangible change. And then the second aspect of that would be in the emergency conflict situations, you work your butt off only to see it undone on a daily basis through sometimes it's bullets, sometimes it's Mother Nature, sometimes. And therefore, there's the, I just took 5 steps forward and then I was pushed back 20. Am I going down the right path here, you think?
Yeah, well, I think that this is a good observation. But let me just see it also from another point of view. You know, if, let's say this is, you know, this is what often happens, you know, in development, you need to wait for 30 years before you can see like the fruit of your work. And maybe you will not be around for that. Probably you will not, because you will have moved on to another organization somewhere else. And in humanitarian and emergency work, again, you know, your work may be destroyed the next day because there's natural disasters or there's bombing or, you know, whatever it is. But if you work in an organization that supports you as a human being and appreciates what you're doing, you know. And sometimes it's really like, I've seen people, I know it sounds like small and maybe even, you know, like silly, and why are we talking about this when there are people who live in poverty and there are people dying? But I think that within work environments of organizations that are interested in doing good, in helping others, I think it's useful if, you know, there is an awareness that we need to do that inside the organization first. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'll support you. I mean, there's plenty of work out there that shows, you know, just because you're poor doesn't mean you're not happy or not
Absolutely.
Satisfied.
Absolutely.
Just because, you know, just because you happen to live in a certain environment, there's a lot of cultural lamination, right? We have a tendency to say, oh, because that life doesn't look like mine, they can't possibly be happy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unfortunately, I've only got time for one more question, Alessandra. This has been a ridiculously fascinating topic, and one I would love to continue much longer.
I think it's complicated, you know, to pack it, you know, like it.
We've cracked the nut. Yeah, we've cracked the nut, and you know, maybe we'll be able to continue to explore it either in other shows or through blog posts or these kinds of things. And people definitely should check out your website, mindfulnext.org. But the last question, ironically, is one that I ask every guest here on the podcast, and that is, you've been an aid worker.
Yes.
You're still an aid worker. You support aid workers. Most of the people who are listening to this show are interested in getting into the business or transitioning into it from another career. Mm-hmm. What's your critical advice, one or two points, about how to create that sustainability and satisfaction over a longer-term career?
It's a very good question. I think I see that younger people now, they tend to be much more informed. You know, people who are just getting out of university in their 20s, they read blogs, they want to know what goes on before jumping into something that, you know, will be, you know, sort of maybe part of their career or maybe not. But so I think, you know, being informed is one thing. You know, of course, aid work, you know, is not just, you know, it's not just a sort of kind of intellectual thing to understand how it works and then I will be fine, you know, once I know that, you know, it's very difficult and there's lots of instability, you know, once I know that, then I will be fine. That's not how it works. But I think to sort of, yeah, educate oneself beyond the books that, you know, you read at university. There's one book that I think it's useful is Letters Left Unsent by an aid worker. He's a blogger, and he goes by the name of Jay, so he's anonymous. And he wrote this book, you know, from his experience having been like working for a couple of decades, I think, in aid. And I think it's useful to read. He's also written some novels about aid work. So I think it's interesting because he gives a perspective from the point of view of somebody who's been in that sector for a long time, and he's blogging anonymously, doesn't have to be, you know, to impress anyone. And he tells things as they are. Sometimes, you know, maybe his words come across as a bit, you know, he's been around for too long, maybe. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think it's worth sort of balancing, you know, coming in with like, you know, like this kind of naive attitude that you're going off to make a difference and save the world. Well, maybe it's helpful to balance it with something else and read something that, you know, I doubt that you read during your course on human rights or, you know, development.
Sure.
And I think also to the other thing that is really crucial is to develop some emotional competencies, you know, like, because being professional also means that you need to be able to deal with your own emotions, deal with other people's emotions, deal with conflicts. And you know, we kind of learned that by doing. You know, you learn it as you stumble upon, you know, a difficult situation. And that's the way it is. You know, it's not, again, it's not something that you can simply learn by reading books. At the same time, I think that reading books and reading blogs and watching videos, you know, all the, there's so much interesting material out there on the internet. And it's helpful because no matter how informed you are and prepared you are, there will be a point where, you know, like it really hits you in the field and you kind of go like, I hate this. This is horrible. You know, I wish I was back home. And then, you know, you can kind of go like, oh, but actually, if I open my toolbox, I know that I have this and that, those tools that can help me and those resources I can rely on. Otherwise, you know, when it really hits you, you're completely like unprepared, and then you will feel abandoned probably, unless you have, you know, like an amazing organization behind you that is supporting you, or you have a mentor. Like I did, I was extremely lucky. I had somebody who was, you know, like available and really helped me out when needed. And it wasn't like, you know, this is the thing. People don't need therapy in the field, not necessarily, but it's more like an ongoing kind of checking it with oneself and with someone else who knows what they're talking about, you know.
Alessandra, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. As I said, I really hope we can continue this conversation either online in the blog or through another conversation.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a wonderful conversation. Really nice to meet you.
You've been listening to the Terms of Reference podcast from aidpreneur.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes.